Each year since 2006, Congress has declared the third week of October to be National Save for Retirement Week. But thanks to the bad economy and falling home prices, most Americans may be in worse shape for retirement than they were just 4 years ago. NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn Geewax is here to talk about retiring comfortably. Welcome back, Marilyn.
Hi, Leanne.
Congress wants us to reflect on retirement planning this week, and I know you've been thinking about it. What have you learned?
Well, I did check with some financial planning experts, and they're very worried about the outlook. For one thing, fewer employers are offering traditional pension plans. Those are the ones where retirees get a set amount of money each month based on how long you worked for a company. Back in 1975, about 35% of workers could look forward to getting those monthly checks in retirement. But today, that's down to about 1 in 4 workers. So instead of counting on those steady pension payouts, most people are really turning to the 401k-type plans to try to save. About 72 million U.S. workers are now enrolled in those kinds of savings plans that are sponsored by their employers. But even those plans are becoming a lot less attractive to workers because a number of employers have stopped offering those matching contributions to the plans.
Has the bad economy actually discouraged workers from putting money into their retirement accounts?
Surprisingly, no. People who have hung on to their jobs have continued to set aside money in their 401ks. But, Leanne, here's the weird thing. More and more people are taking money out of their accounts through these hardship withdrawals. I called the folks at Fidelity Investments, which is a big provider of workplace retirement savings plans, and they said they're seeing that about 1 in 4 people now have some kind of an outstanding loan withdrawal type thing from their 401k. And it looks like what we're seeing is that people really do want to save for retirement. And so they ask their employers to divert some of their wages into these savings accounts. But then the economy is so bad, they get into trouble. Maybe their spouse loses a job, the car breaks down, their credit's too low to get a loan. So they end up having to take money out of their 401k through a hardship withdrawal. And, of course, that ends up triggering all kinds of penalties and tax consequences. So it ends up being this huge financial setback.
Well, this is supposed to be recovery now. Is the worst of this 401k borrowing over?
No, in a way, it's getting worse. Fidelity said that in the first 3 months of this year, 45,000 participants in their plans took out these hardship loans. And in the second quarter, that jumped up to 62,000 of these hardship withdrawals. So that suggests that a lot of people have used up their savings. They can't get loans because of bad credit. And so, yes, we're in this technical recovery, but we're seeing a lot of evidence that the economy is still making it really tough for people to plan for retirement.
What do most people have in savings?
The majority of Americans have less than $25,000 in savings. And remember that home prices are down dramatically across the board. So, you know, the idea that you can just sell your house in retirement and live off of all that home equity, that's becoming less and less true for most Americans. And this has people clearly worrying. I talked to the Employee Benefits Research Institute, which is a group that studies retirement planning, and they say that their surveys show that 4 years ago, 27% of people said that they were very confident they could retire comfortably. Now that's down to just 16%.
Is anything being done to help people save? I mean, besides reminding them once a year to do it?
Well, last week, the Labor Department tried to take a step that would help a little bit. Starting in 2012, the government is going to require employers to do more to disclose what fees are being charged on these things and also to provide performance data so that you have a better idea of which mutual fund to choose. In other words, you, the saver, you should be able to make better decisions about how to invest and whether or not to take money out of your account. And the hope is that if you have more information, you'll make better decisions about how to invest.
Marilyn Geewax is NPR Senior Business Editor. Marilyn, thanks a lot.
Oh, you're welcome, Leanne.
Speaking of sinners and saints, in a ceremony at the Vatican today, Pope Benedict XVI ushered a new saint into the Roman Catholic canon. Mother Mary MacKillop is the first Australian to be canonized. In 1866, MacKillop helped found an order of nuns, the Sisters of St. Joseph of the Sacred Heart. The sisters were, and still are, dedicated to working with children in the remote areas of Australia's outback. Father James Martin is with the Jesuit magazine America. He wrote an editorial this past week calling MacKillop a saint for our time. He joins us from New York. Welcome, Father Martin.
Nice to be with you.
Tell us a little bit more about who she was and how she came to found this order.
Well, she came from a large Catholic family. She was born in 1842, eight kids. She had started to work with poor children as a governess, and she came into contact with a priest named Father Julian Tennyson Woods. And together they realized that a lot of the children in the outback and in remote areas weren't being served, and so she started to teach them. And then that led to the founding, along with Father Woods, of the Sisters of St. Joseph. And, you know, she's doing that at a very young age. She's around 25 when she helps to found the order.
Wow. How did she come to be considered for sainthood?
Well, you know, a lot of the religious order's founders are really looked at, you know, carefully for their sort of holy lives. She worked with the poor, and she also underwent a great deal of suffering in her life. She was among very few saints. She was excommunicated, and she sort of bore that with great dignity.
She was excommunicated. It was for a brief period, right, in 1871. Why was she excommunicated?
Well, it's very complicated. The official reason was insubordination. Now, powerful women, especially a young woman in that time, would have been very threatening to bishops who wanted to sort of keep women's orders under their control. But also, it was revealed recently that her sisters had unearthed a case of sex abuse. And to sort of punish her, in a sense, a friend of the guy who was abused had manipulated the bishop into excommunicating Mother MacKillop. And so she really suffered, you know, as a result of the sex abuse that had occurred.
It did take a lot of grit for her for them to call out a priest for sex abuse in those days. I mean, we're talking the turn of the century.
Oh, of course. I mean, imagine a sister in Australia sort of pointing the finger, and then imagine Mother MacKillop having to stand up for her sisters. When I heard the news of this, I was quite moved, and I thought it's quite providential that she's stepping back on the world stage at this time.
So why was the excommunication order revoked later?
I think within a few months, Bishop Scheel, the person who had issued the excommunication, really realized the wrong that he had done against Mother MacKillop, and on his deathbed, I think, recanted. But, you know, she continued to have problems with bishops. After that, a few years later, another bishop who didn't like her, you know, exercising so much control over the order that she had founded, removed her, in a sense, and placed another woman as Mother General. So the story of women religious and these women religious orders are really often the story of women finding it difficult to exercise the proper authority over the orders that they founded.
How well known is your story in Australia?
Oh, very well known. She's a national hero. There's stamps in her honor. This is a great day for Australia. She's the first Australian saint, and she's much beloved there. And her order, the Sisters of St. Joseph, affectionately called the Joeys, are still very much involved in teaching and working with the poor. I mean, this is one of these great women that that you find in Catholic history, just these redoubtable, strong women that really helped to build up the church.
Given that sexual abuse by priests is a major issue in these times, one that the Pope has had to address, is there any reason to believe the timing of Mother Mary MacKillop's canonization isn't a coincidence?
Oh, you know, some have thought that the church is actually doing this, you know, as a result of the sex abuse that was, you know, part of her story. But this really just came up recently, and I think it's actually providential. I think that for Catholics to have someone as an example and to pray to, someone who had really undergone great suffering as a result of unearthing this case of abuse, I think is very providential. I was quite moved when I heard of the news, and I thought that, you know, here's someone, a sort of patron saint for sex abuse victims that people can pray to now for her intercession, for her help in heaven.
And is this why you call her a saint for our time?
She's a saint for our time for a number of reasons, not only the sex abuse. I mean, you don't want to reduce her life just to that incident, but she's a strong woman who is working with the poor, you know, which is still an issue today. She's a woman of faith, you know, in a time when, you know, women were seen as kind of less than. And she just led a very holy life, and she kept her wits about her. She kept her sense of humor, and she kept her faith throughout all these very difficult trials. So really a saint for any time.
Father James Martin is an editor with America Magazine and the author of My Life with the Saints. Thank you very much, Father Martin.
My pleasure.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. By the year 2030, 1 billion people on the planet will be over the age of 65. And, for the first time in history, the number of those who are older than 50 will be greater than those under 17. Ted Fishman has traveled around the world to find out the effects this aging trend will have on families and communities, nations and economies. His new book is called Shock of Gray, and he's in the studio of member station WBEZ in Chicago. Welcome to the program.
Glad to join you.
Your subtitle's a little grim, The Aging of the World's Population and How It Pits Young Against Old, Child Against Parent, Worker Against Boss, Company Against Rival, and Nation Against Nation. Is this as apocalyptic as it sounds?
Well, the title's a snapshot of the present because we haven't thought through at the top of our intelligence how to deal with the shock of gray. So that means that there are default solutions, and many of those are coming in the form of what businesses do around an aging population, often reconfiguring the economics of old age, and those effects are sobering.
What do you mean reconfiguring?
Well, you know, we are used to, in the United States and Europe, an old age which is defined by leisure, by retirement. But we are incapable of keeping our promises to ourselves. Either the fortunes of the market have reversed, governments are incapable of stepping up to keep the promises because we just don't have enough money. And so this puts the demand on older people to work longer.
Is this aging trend spread out across the globe or is it confined to developed countries?
It's spread out across the globe. We're just doing it at a different pace. We're comfortably behind Europe and much of East Asia, but the developing world is coming along rapidly. Hmm. Leanne, there's several ways to measure how a country ages. One is, are people living longer? Another is, what is the percentage of people who are older in the population? And if you look at any of those measures, everywhere in the world is getting older, but the biggest numbers are the shifts in the percentage, the proportion of older people that are part of the population. And these are quite dramatic.
You went to Tokyo, Japan, which has more old people than any other city in the world. And you're right that Japan leads the way for other countries because its population is both aging and shrinking. How does that affect society and the relationship between young and old?
Oh, it's quite dramatic. You know, Tokyo is an interesting place because it is so huge. And when you go there, you could see a whole street, throngs of people, all in their 70s and above, or most in their 70s above, and a service and retail economy that's built around them, and housing that's built around them. And what this is a snapshot of where most of Japan will be heading, because it will be a country where 30% of the population before long will be over 65. You know, I talked before about the reconfiguration of the economic lives of older people. Well, you could see it in Japan, too. So the group that is shopping there, surprisingly, is also a group that's very heavily employed in Japan. Japan has the highest participation of its older workers in the workforce of any country in the world, any developed country in the world. And what happens is that they retire. They don't have enough money to live in expensive Tokyo very frequently. And they need to work. So the day they retire, they're given a gold watch. 2 days later, their employer calls them and says, how would you like to come back to work for half of your pay? We'll give you everything you had before, except we're just paying you half and we're not paying your benefits because your pension and the government will cover your benefits. So you have this vast army of contingent workers, contract workers, who act just like regular full-time factory workers in Japan, for example. They've already been tested as workers. Employers like them. They regard them as family. And a young worker trying to get into the workforce, competing with those older workers, has a very, very hard time.
Developed countries like the United States made major technological advances that prolong life, so the population ages. But there's a downside economically. For example, many state budgets are hobbled by the high costs of pension fund payouts. Are you describing a win-lose situation here?
Well, we certainly win, right? There's nothing better for people than longer life and healthier life. That's what mankind's wanted forever. And if you want any definition of progress, that's a pretty good one. The question is, like all progress, how do we deal with the ramifications of it? So we will have to make choices on where the resources go. If people were postponing some of these decisions to exit the workforce, or if they were made more valuable in the workforce by training, for example, training themselves, going to school, whatever. You can find escape from a lot of these giant obligations that we face.
What effect did the research and writing of this book have on how you think about your own aging?
You know, I really did feel the time tick down as I was writing the book, because you can live to be a vital 90-year-old, or you can be quite hobbled in your late 50s. And it really gave me a lens in which to see everything that was in my view when I walked out my door. I was really looking at people saying, where in the stage of life are they? How dependent are they? How reliant can I be on them? So now I'm just seeing it everywhere.
Ted Fishman, his new book is called Shock of Gray. An excerpt appears in today's New York Times Magazine. He spoke to us from member station WBEZ in Chicago. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Try to buy some concert tickets or create a new email account, and you're usually confronted with a puzzle of sorts. A box appears with a distorted word that sometimes isn't even a word, and you have to retype it. If you tilt your head or squint your eyes, you usually can make it out. And that's the point. These puzzles are called CAPTCHAs. A human can decipher them, but a computer set up by a spammer or a hacker can't. So, to get around the problem, spammers and mass ticket purchasers have outsourced CAPTCHA solving to teams of low-wage workers in places like Russia and Southeast Asia, and many of them don't speak English. Stefan Savage is a professor in the Department of Computer Science and Engineering at the University of California, San Diego. He recently co-wrote a paper on the economics of this underground CAPTCHA trade, and he joins us now from UCSD. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So, there's this outsourcing of CAPTCHA solving. How does this work? I mean, you're finding other humans to solve these CAPTCHAs instead of computers?
Precisely. So the whole premise behind the CAPTCHA is you want to allow users to access your service as long as they're an actual person, but you don't want to allow miscreants on the internet to sign up for, say, hundreds of thousands of Hotmail accounts. And so you put this screen in the way that a human can solve, but a computer can't en masse. So what these miscreants did in response is they simply outsourced the task of solving them to effectively sweatshop labor, where people will just sit and be given these images to solve and will type them in all day.
Usually these CAPTCHAs have to be solved pretty quickly to get through to the site. So how fast are these workers?
They, generally speaking, can turn around a CAPTCHA in between 10 and 20 seconds. They're probably a little better at it than we are because they do it all day.
But what if they don't speak English?
They don't need to speak English. The beauty of most modern CAPTCHAs is that they simply take Latin characters, so they don't actually need to understand what the words mean. They simply need to be able to look at the symbols and type the appropriate ones on their keyboard.
How much are they paid?
Very little.
Oh.
So on the labor side, the going rate is about 75 cents per 1,000 CAPTCHAs solved. It's about $2 or $3 a day, and it's really in line with some of the lowest paid textile work around, although probably the quality of life is slightly better than being in a textile mill.
Is it legal to do this?
It's something of a gray area. It's not clear what law is being broken in simply solving the CAPTCHAs. Hmm. The solvers themselves, particularly in other countries, it's not clear that in fact they're breaking a law, even though fundamentally what they're doing is supporting a fraudulent activity.
Is this a big problem?
No. So the interesting thing about this is that on the one hand, CAPTCHAs do not keep the bad guys out. But at the same time, they actually are effective at keeping the problem in control. So even at that very low cost, 75 cents, say, per thousand, they have to be able to make enough money, send enough spam from each one of those accounts that it ends up being worthwhile. And so even that very low drag turns out to be enough to weed out a huge number of the people who would play this game.
Stefan Savage is a professor in the Department of Computer Science and Engineering at the University of California, San Diego. Thank you very much.
Thank you.